Hello, patrons, and welcome to the patron special for October 2018. As promised this month, we're going to be talking about the 1968, I believe, Roman Polanski classic Rosemary's Baby. Now, first off, Roman Polanski, we know, is kind of a gross dude and raped somebody.
This movie was before that, so it's kind of grandfathered in, I figure.
Yeah, it's kind of grandfathered in. I mean, we're not going to be doing the pianist on the patron special anytime soon. And also, Roman Polanski should be in prison. So that aside, Rosemary's Baby is one of my favorite movies. I have seen it many, many times. And I make it a point of watching it around this time every year. So figured this would be a good one to do.
And it's particularly funny because the day that we're recording this, Eric was just saying before we recorded, he was watching the live Christine Blasey Ford opening statement. So to be watching a horror movie which is literally about a woman who has no control over any aspect of her own body or life is, at the time that Brett Kavanaugh may or may not be confirmed, spoiler alert, he will be, is pretty interesting. It's some apt timing, I'd say.
I definitely think it's apt timing. Rosemary's Baby is a fascinating movie because every time I watch it, I get something different and more. I get something different out of it. And on this watch, what I found so fascinating about it is how everybody in Rosemary's life treats her as an object. And I'm not just talking about the Castevets, who are witches and Satanists and want to bring about the Antichrist and the end of the world. I'm not just talking about her doctors, although we can talk a lot about how doctors treated their women patients and how they continue to treat their women patients, frankly. Her husband, I mean, just pretty much everyone in her life treats her as an object, except for a couple of key characters, which I think we will talk about in the course of this conversation. And
Hutch and her, like, old friends, the people her age, pretty much.
Right, exactly. And I guess how I want to start this conversation is, so you have seen this movie before as well.
A bunch of times, yeah.
And so I know it's one of your – I don't know if I would say it's one of your favorites. What would you call it?
I don't know. It was a very formative movie for me. Like, I saw it at, you know, in middle school or early high school. Like, you know, just on the cusp of being ready for it, if you know what I mean. And I did find it a very affecting movie. It's one that I've always enjoyed watching. And – I think it's an extraordinarily well-done movie just on every aspect of it. I mean, part of the reason Polanski is such a controversial figure is because he made some amazing movies, obviously, and there is always that difficulty with somebody who has done something so well being an awful person, that tension there. And I would say, frankly, the movie, I think, draws a lot of its power from Roman Polanski himself. Like, watching this, you know, my partner was saying stuff like, oh, it's, you know, this is the movie that he's making right before, you know, this is a movie that he made so that he was able to completely control a woman. Like, there's almost something Hitchcock and Vertigo about this movie where it can be argued that it is the creator torturing a woman for fun and filming it.
Yeah, well, I certainly see that read of the movie, and I don't necessarily disagree with it, but I think that this is a difficult movie to examine because you can certainly make that argument. You can certainly say that Roman Polanski was just essentially acting out some sort of sadomasochistic sexual fantasy on the part of Mia Farrow. But I also think that you can also read this movie as you know, a commentary on the ways in which women are treated by society. And perhaps both of those are valid readings of this movie.
I mean, we must take into account the fact that, I mean, this was a year before Sharon Tate was killed, right? And the more charitable interpretations of Polanski essentially, you know, talk about how he had a breakdown after that and, you know, lost all say, you know, and all of that. I mean, it was
right.
The rape that he committed was a few years later. And so I think there is a bit of, you know, again, that charges the movie for me in a lot of ways.
And I think it's also interesting because so this was Roman Polanski's first American film.
Okay.
And he had obviously had, you know, fame and acclaim for some previous movies that he made in Europe. And, you know, he had moved to America, I believe, in 1966 or 1967. And, you know, we can talk a lot about his directing style, a lot of the sort of like cinema verite style that he does. You know, I think a key scene for that is all of the sort of like location shooting in Manhattan, which was uncommon in American movies at the time. And so, yeah. So a lot of, I mean, this is something that was going on in American film in general in the 60s and 70s. But I also think it's interesting to think about the fact that his wife, Sharon Tate, was in their Los Angeles home when she was murdered. And, you know, if he had never come to America, she may not have been murdered. So, you know, it's another little irony of life, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it's a complex situation and a dark and fucked up situation, this whole thing. But again, I think that gives the movie a bit of awful power to me. Like, again, the circumstances which surround its creator are so fucked up that, again, this tale about a woman who loses all control of her own body and is just beset upon by everybody around her who is pretending to be doing good for her and is just using her for whatever ends. I mean, I think that this is a very gross and disturbing movie, and I mean, it should be, it needs to be.
Yeah, for sure. And we can dive into that. I think that one of the things that I want to start off talking about is just kind of placing this in a context of Roman Polanski. And, you know, certainly I think that the interpretation of this movie as here is Roman Polanski who wants complete control over this woman and is just basically putting her through a bunch of psychological torture. That reading of Rosemary's Baby, I think, is actually supported by some of his other films, most notably Repulsion, which, you know, features a very young Catherine Deneuve as a woman living in, I believe it's London. It's been a while since I've seen it in London. And she basically is just like psychologically tortured because of her alienation from society. And that's Rosemary's Baby is kind of a more commercial interpretation of that yeah. same theme. At the same time, I do think that the movie doesn't necessarily have sympathy for the ways in which people treat Rosemary, most notably because textually they're all Satanists.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's much more sympathetic to Rosemary, although in an oddly paternalistic way. I mean, it really is. I don't know, actually, that because that's something that I find curious about it. Does the movie give Rosemary agency at the end or not? And does this movie worry about Rosemary in a fatherly way that denies Rosemary agency? Or does it say this is really fucked up what is happening to women? Does the movie consider itself a white knight running in to save her?
That's a good question, and I don't really know. I mean, I think we certainly spend the most time with Rosemary yeah. than any other character. She is in the movie. She is definitely the main character of the movie.
Do we spend any time outside her perspective even?
No, I don't believe so. I think that's the most interesting part of the movie is that it's all pretty much told from her point of view. We never get scenes with her husband alone.
Yeah.
We never get scenes with the Castevets alone. And what is interesting about it is that, you know, I mean, just on the level of a pure psychological thriller, it's very well done. You know, you get these wonderful moments where she's overhearing things from the Castevets apartment. She's having these, you know, crazy elaborate dreams and those sorts of things. You know, she is definitely the focal character of the movie and everything that happens is from her perspective. And the movie does ratchet that up, of course, you know, early on. It's pretty much told as a just a, you know, straight drama. And you're kind of wondering, where is this going? Where is this going? And by the end of the movie, she is, you know, the movie is basically having her have auditory hallucinations. And it's fascinating, but then it's also true because they're not hallucinations, right? Like they're kind of like shot and portrayed in the movie as hallucinations, but they're not really, because everything that's going on is actually happening.
Yeah,
or is it? I guess that's the question at the end of the movie. But
yeah, well, the rape scene, for example, that entire thing is, she's very drugged during that, so she's drifting in and out of sleep, and she's, you know, again having visions, but they correspond very neatly to what happened, which is that she was dragged through the thing. There was a ritual around her. She was raped by the devil. And, you know, she's just seeing – she's seeing reality but interpreting through the madness that she has been given through all of the gaslighting throughout the movie.
And, you know, what's interesting about that too is that we never really get a good sense of who she is in terms of her background. I mean, we know she comes from Omaha, I believe, or somewhere else in the Midwest. We know that she's young. We know that she's married to Guy. She doesn't work. She doesn't have a job. We don't really know anything about her interests. We don't really know anything about her background. And those dream sequences are really the only moments in the film that provide us with any sort of information about her background, because they are populated by characters that do not appear. I mean, some of the characters in the dreams do appear in the movie in other places, but, you know, I'm thinking in terms of like the Catholic priest, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, the sailors on the boat, you know, stuff like that. Some of it is just weird dream sequences, but I also think that we are supposed to interpret some of that as telling the audience something about where she comes from, you know, because we know, for instance, that she is Catholic because they talk about that at the dinner party, those sorts of things. And it's all information that is provided to us to give us an incomplete picture of who she is.
Yeah. Now, have you read the book of it?
I have. I read it a long time ago.
Yeah, because I did too. And actually, one of the reasons – it's a remarkable literal interpretation of the book. It is – I mean, Polanski famously took – most of the dialogue is lifted right from the book. And William Castle even said that he believed that Polanski didn't know that he was allowed to make big changes to it, for example.
Right.
And whether or not you think that, you know, that was a joke or not, I don't know. But the point is, it is a very straightforward adaptation of it. And so the book does go a little further into it. For example, the, you know, that's supposed to be John Kennedy that she's talking to on the ship. And the woman who comes down and is comforting her is supposed to be Jackie Kennedy, Jackie Onassis at that point. Which obviously for a Catholic woman in 1966 would be very much on her mind. It goes a little more into her backstory that she had come from a large Catholic family in Omaha, got into some trouble in school, which is what the bit with the windows is supposed to be about. Like, I remember they explain what exactly that incident is. And they go a little further into that, you know, Guy is not a Catholic, and that causes kind of a break with her family, because one of the big questions of this is, well, why the hell doesn't she leave and go to her mother's at any point?
Right.
And part of her estrangement from her family, that provides that answer. And which kind of makes the scene at the end where she has the dream where she's just surrounded by all those people and she has the baby, and it's, you know, she's brought the baby home to Omaha, a little more poignant, because that's the version of her in a way that did go home to her mother's. And of course,
yeah, I think
because we know this is Satan's baby, that's impossible. But
yeah, I think that's a really good point, because that is one of the central questions at the heart of the movie is, yeah, she is very, I mean, on the textual level, she is very alienated, and she is alienated, if we take the information from the novel, that she is estranged from her family because Guy isn't Catholic. Okay, great, fine. Whether or not, I mean, that's obviously not in the movie itself, but you can interpret that she doesn't have a good relationship with her family, because you're right, like, why wouldn't she just go home? But on the other level, I think it works really well in having her be a little bit of she's kind of a stand-in for women in general, because this movie is very much about the ways in which women are treated by society. And I struggle with this question because Roman Polanski did drug and rape a 13-year-old girl. Yeah. But I don't think Roman Polanski is a great guy. And certainly he has very, people that sexually assault or rape women, you know, have particular opinions about women that are not great. I struggle with this as well because I'm not a heterosexual, so I have like different, you know, I feel weird talking about this sometimes because I don't really have a vested interest in this topic. Yeah. Other than I want to see women treated as people. But on the other hand, I think it's interesting because you can simultaneously have someone like Roman Polanski want to make a movie that he gets rocks off by basically torturing Mia Farrow / Rosemary Woodhouse. On the other hand, I think that you can very easily see him being a youngish, somewhat progressive, quote-unquote, yeah, guy who wants to tell a story of how women are treated by society. And I think that that's probably the part of the movie that has held up the best, has aged the best, because this movie still feels very vibrant and very necessary in a way.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that, again, this is a very faithful adaptation of the novel. I don't know that much about Ira Levin. I read another book of his, A Kiss Before Dying, which is a, you know, serial killer who targets women kind of novel. I mean, that was the genre that he was writing in largely, but you could also picture him being somebody who is sympathetic towards women and does want to write a horror story where, again, that societal treatment is the horror. Like, I think it might even come from the author's sensibility that is just going to come across in the story. I mean, that could,
yeah,
that's a factor we can't deny either.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I don't know anything really about Ira Levin myself, and I mean, I think that it's always difficult to talk about men of a certain age in a certain era.
Yeah.
Because we just don't know. I mean, we can interpret and we can sort of like take our knowledge of what society was like at that time and extrapolate out. But at the same time, we are looking at a movie which does feature Rosemary Woodhouse as a stand-in for, I think, women in general. And she also is treated pretty much the same by a wide swath of society, right? I mean,
yeah,
she's treated like a child, basically, by her husband. She is treated like a child by the Castevet. She is treated like a child by the doctor played by Charles Grodin, for instance, right? And
yeah,
that tells me that this is something that is intentional, that her being controlled by the Castevets or her husband even, and we will talk about her husband because,
yeah,
wow, that she is treated as a child, she is treated as an object, she is treated as a means to an end. She is not treated as a person, as an independent person with,
yeah,
her own agency.
I mean,
let's talk about her haircut, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, the closest that she is treated like a person is her old landlord, Hutch, who, based on their age differences, he is a little fatherly, grandfatherly towards her, but he is actually one of the few characters who talks to her plainly, frankly. I mean, everybody says, oh, you look like shit because of the haircut. But when he's saying, like, you look bad, he's, you know, trying to say, like, plainly, you're sick. Something is very wrong here. I am seeing signs of abuse, maybe even.
And I think that, I mean, and let's not forget that he is described on more than one occasion in the movie as a writer of adventure stories,
yeah,
for boys, which I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
Like, I think he's supposed to be like a Hardy Boys kind of writer. That was what he did.
No, no, no. I know.
Yeah.
I know textually what it means. I just don't know why they keep insisting on that in the movie. Like, is that some sort of weird coded homosexual thing or something? I don't really get it. But
it's, you know, I mean, I see it as a bit of a way of saying, well, you know, all of this thing with witches is absurd, and, you know, Hutch is just a crazy old dude who was about to get ill and go into a coma, and he had a very active imagination, and so he saw, you know, a friend of his just being ill and imagine this whole witchcraft plot out of that. And Rosemary is so naive and stupid, and she has her pregnancy hysteria that she went along with it and ran with it. I mean, that's, I think, where they're trying to go with that.
Yeah, that's fair. I just want to see closeted homosexuals and everything. Well, let's talk about her husband then, because I think that, played by John Cassavetes, which is great, but he is really interesting because on first glance you think that their relationship is fine. They have a loving relationship. Yeah. They're looking at this apartment together. You know, they're kissing, they're holding hands, all this kind of stuff. But as you watch the movie more, and I think as you watch the movie multiple times, you really do get a sense that he doesn't fundamentally, Guy does not care about what happens to Rosemary. That she is a means to an end.
Yeah.
And she's there to bring him a beer and a sandwich when he gets home from auditions. She is there to make him a nice home. She is there to give him children. But he doesn't fundamentally care about her as a person, doesn't care about her wants, her needs, her emotions. And I think key to that is the revelation at the end of the movie that he has taken to the Cassavetes and he wants to be famous so badly that he essentially lets his wife be raped and impregnated by Satan and doesn't care, right? Like, he's mildly embarrassed by it. Like, she walked in on him masturbating.
Well, let's be honest. Let's say there is no witchcraft. They don't go through witches, but he just naturally gets a break. And I think one of the things I noticed this time, I think the movie is suggesting that he's actually not a good actor at all, because any time we see him acting or doing an impression, it's terrible. Like, he does the worst mini Cassavetes impression. That's not unintentional. But he is going – if he actually did make it to Hollywood on his own, he's going to end up, you know, carrying on with another actress or a star or somebody, and Rosemary will be his first wife. I mean, that is very real what's going to happen.
And what is going to happen to her then, right? Because
the best she'll get is some alimony, and then again she ends up back in Omaha with the baby and her family. I mean, that's Rosemary's life if there are no witches.
But I do wonder about her, because I want to make this centered around her as a character, because I think that we need to give her the credit that she is due. Like, I don't understand what she thinks she's getting out of this. And is it just that she thinks that this is what she is supposed to do? I mean, even before her husband makes a deal with the Satanists that live across the hall and have her raped by Satan, like, I don't get the sense that she's satisfied by her life. And
I mean, obviously, I'm getting a lot of this, you know, I'm reminded of Mad Men a lot because it's the same you know, same era, same location, same world. I mean, this is the New York that Mad Men was partially recreating. And, you know, in a way, the Don and Betty relationship reminds me a bit of theirs, in that Betty is somebody who was raised to be a housewife, to have children, to marry a handsome, successful man. And she does all of that, and she's just utterly unsatisfied because she's not really good at any of those things. She wanted to have a very different life. And that's almost, you know, Rosemary seems like the kind of person who was raised to meet a nice man and have a big family and be a housewife. And she is a good little girl who does all of that. And it's because that's just what you do. And so, okay, she met a famous, you know, she met a handsome actor and she fell in love and they went to New York City. And is that what Rosemary wants? I feel like the vision of just her with her family at the end suggests that maybe she did want just a simpler life.
Well, yeah, I think so. But also, I don't know. I mean, I think the question is, how did she end up in New York in the first place? And, you know, maybe she met Guy and they moved to New York together. But I would kind of doubt it, because she seems to have a lot of friends from a previous life that she doesn't really see anymore. And they don't really seem to be Guy's friends, honestly. Like, it, you know, what was in Rosemary that made her want to move to New York? I mean, that was something that was, I mean, when you move to New York from Omaha, Nebraska in 1960, there's a reason why you're doing it, right? And did she want to be an actor? Did she want to be a model? Did she want to be a singer? Did she want to be a dancer? Did she, you know, what did she want? And we don't know. She's a cipher in a way. And I mean, again, I think that's intentional. I'm not criticizing Rosemary as a person. I think the movie is doing what it is doing very deliberately and not giving us a lot of information about who she is. I mean, the most we ever see her enjoy is like a novel and a piece of music at one point. But aside from that, we don't really get a sense that she really has any interests or hobbies of her own. And she really wants to be pregnant. She really wants to have children, but you know, is that something that she actually wants? I don't know. And There's an isolation here, which I think is indicative of the ways in which women of that era were kind of like brainwashed into thinking that that's what they wanted. And yeah, certainly some women do want that, right? And that's fine. But a lot of women didn't want that.
Yeah.
And the question at the heart of the movie is, how did she end up in this position in the first place with a husband who fundamentally does not care about her to the degree that he will make a pact with his crazy Satanist neighbors to have his wife raped and impregnated by Satan?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I'm thinking even of the that sex scene when they're, you know, in the apartment, you know, they don't even have any furniture and they're just, you know, eating like a little picnic in their living room. And, you know, it's they have this really awkward undressing scene and it's just not remotely sexy at all. I mean, this,
oh no,
you know, even the non-rape sex scenes are just kind of gross to look at. And, you know, that should be a cute little moment and it's not. And
oh, they're in different planets. I mean, I think it's actually really important to examine that particular scene a little bit more closely because I'm glad you brought it up because it's very indicative of their relationship. You know, they're sitting in the living room of their new apartment with a lamp on the floor, eating a little bit of food off a blanket or whatever they're doing. And Rosemary says to him, "Let's make love." And he doesn't say anything, which is interesting.
Yeah.
He kind of like has this little pause. He kind of goes, all right, you know, and he doesn't say all right. He doesn't say anything, but you can just kind of see it in his body language.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, sure. What else are we going to do? Unplugs the lamp.
Yeah.
And then sort of just like takes his clothes off in the most like he's getting ready for bed. And
frankly, they're both on opposite sides of the little lamp. They undress completely separately. It's not like they're, you know,
does she even take her clothes off?
I thought she does.
Does. Okay.
She does. But again, they're doing it just completely separate. It's as, you know, practically other opposite sides of the room, certainly opposite sides of the shot.
Yeah, it's just – it's very mechanistic. You know, she obviously – so obviously wants to connect with Guy and she continues to want to connect with Guy and he fundamentally does not care about her.
I mean, they have several times like a, oh, this is a fresh start. Oh, baby, I'm sorry. We're going to – it's going to be great from this point now. And, you know, oh
– well, he is
– yeah, it's so sad every
Guy,
time.
Guy continues – yeah, well, Guy continues to say all of those things when he is about to lose her and wants to hook her again, right? I mean, that is essentially what he is doing. And, you know, the whole baby thing is indicative of that. And why does he tell her they want to have a baby? Well, probably because he made a pact with his crazy Satanist neighbors, like, to become famous, you know? And I think that it's just so it's indicative of the ways in which I think men in this time period we're really looking at women. Now, obviously not all men, but
no,
enough of them that it was a problem.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the movie is exaggerated in many ways. If the old people at the end screaming "Hail Satan" and the music, you know, doesn't clue you in, this is a bit of camp, but it's a very heightened response of, again, how controlled she is, how that she has a very specific, defined, tiny place and role, and it's at the pleasure of her husband mainly.
Well, yeah, exactly. And once she starts to go out of that, once she starts to violate that, I mean, she is one of the key moments in the movie is this sort of like 20-minute plot line where in the initial stages of her pregnancy, She is looking very sickly. She is looking ill. She is losing weight. She keeps saying she has this pain constantly that's not going away around her abdomen. And none of this is a good thing, right? Like, none of this is normal pregnancy. I mean, as Hutch, their old landlord, you know, says when he comes to visit her, that she doesn't look well and that you know, pregnant women gain weight. And she's being gaslighted by everyone, frankly. I mean, she's being gaslighted by Dr. Saperstein, the doctor who the Castevets and Guy send her to. She's being gaslighted by the Castevets. She's being gaslighted by Guy. She is not believing her own her own body, right? And when she gets up the gumption to say, look, I want to go back to the other doctor, the one that isn't famous and the Castevets have nothing to do with, Guy is very upset with her. And
he literally says, I'm not going to let you do that. Like, he talks a lot in this movie about giving her permission to or to not do something.
Which I think is a very common sort of attitude at this time period. But what is so fascinating about it is that, once again, the movie does a very good job of straddling two things, the textual and the subtextual. The textual, of course, is that Guy doesn't want her to go back to Dr. Hill because Dr. Saperstein is in on the Satanist cult and doesn't want her to find that out. The subtextual thing, of course, is that a man controls his wife.
You think about things that real cults do, and they do insulate you from people who are going to be able to help you, whether it's her friends who tell her very practical advice, like, look, this is wrong, this is fucked up, here's what you need to do, or a doctor who is going to, frankly, see that there is a devil fetus in her, again, more subtextually, see signs of spousal abuse.
Right. Yeah. I think that's true. And, well,
go ahead. Well, I was going to say, maybe this is a little too early to talk about Dr. Hill at the end, but oh my God, the Old Boys Network in action.
Yes, for sure. And well, I think let's talk about that then, because that would be a nice capper to, you know, talking about how women weren't being taken seriously in this society.
Yeah.
Because that's another example of a woman's quote-unquote hysteria, which of course is an incredibly gendered term that no one should ever use. But I use that term very deliberately because that is what they were being – it would have been considered. And
it literally,
comes at the height of the end of the movie of her paranoia, her justified paranoia, frankly. And it's such a violation of her as a person that Dr. Hill listens to her, thinks, you know, doesn't give any indication that he doesn't believe her, although he's very careful not to say he believes her. I think that the key moment of that is, and I love how careful the script is, because she says, oh, you know, it's a Satanist cult and and they want to take my baby, and he says, well, it certainly seems that way, right? He doesn't say oh yeah or no. He's very deliberately says it certainly seems that way. And then, of course, they come and they take her away again.
Well, you get the sense that when she first tells her story, again, he's realizing there is something very wrong with this woman. All right. This is New York City. This is a woman who is mentally ill. That's what he's figuring has happened. And just like she's falling through the cracks and she just needs some kind of help. So, okay, let me arrange a stay in Bellevue for her. And that's okay. And here's who I need to call. And we need to get a psychologist. And, we need to call child welfare because there's going to be. And then the second she hears Saperstein, she thinks, all right, well, I'm going to. That's all this is. He needs to be taking care of her. She's Saperstein's responsibility, and Saperstein is an okay guy. And
what you can see here is the way, and this is kind of related now to sort of Me Too and stuff, which is that the ways in which powerful and well-respected men will use their position in order to continue to subjugate and abuse women.
Yeah. She's in good hands already. Let me just deliver this wayward sheep back to where she's supposed to be.
I mean, he does lie to her, of course. He does say, look, how would you like to go to Sinai tonight? And that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And, I don't know what to make of Dr. Hill, except that he is – I don't think he's a bad guy, which makes it probably even worse.
Because, again, from his perspective – Saperstein is his credentials are impeccable. He is 10 years ago Bill Cosby, you know, and he, you know, could not have done these crazy things. Saperstein would never be a Satanist. That's ridiculous. I think he is somebody who does care about his patients and probably is an excellent doctor. And yet at the same time, he is still a male doctor in the Boys Club in New York in the 1960s. I mean, I only – does it, let's not forget that Dr. Cosby in his show was an obstetrician. I mean, I think that's an odd resonance. You know, with all of the women who talk about how handsome Dr. Hill is, don't you think he became a gyno to meet women?
Oh, God, no. That's terrible. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on right now that's terrible. Bill Cosby just got sentenced yesterday, and he's going...
Isn't he in jail?
He's going to prison.
Jesus.
It was big news here, of course, because I now live in Philadelphia. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the cast of vets then, because we haven't talked about them. And I never know quite what to make of them because this movie very deliberately is so good at misdirection. Mm. And there are only a few moments in the movie where if you're not quite paying attention, it's just going to slide over you.
Yeah.
There's one moment when she is pregnant, but they're at their house for the new year, and it's very early in her pregnancy, and they're all toasting to the new year. And what's the Castevets, Mr. Castevets?
Roman
Castevets. What a great name.
I would say Roman Castevets, Roman Polanski. I mean, let's also, there are a lot of resonances. That's all I'll say.
Very true. he gives a toast to year one.
Yeah.
Which I think is the first indication verbally that something very, 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 very strange is going on.
Yeah.
But if you're not really paying attention, it would just kind of glide over you and you wouldn't really notice it. And obviously Minnie Castevets is played for comedy, and she was played by, you know, a very, you know, famous sort of like theater actress and film actress who kind of played a lot of those similar roles. And obviously that is a misdirection on the part of Roman Polanski, because he wants her to appear as non-threatening as possible.
Yeah.
She's a doddering old woman. How could she ever be? And obviously she's incredibly calculating, right? And all of the questions, this is what's so interesting to me about it, is that everything that, you know, she's asking Rosemary questions. And if you don't know the plot of the movie, if you don't know what's going on, you think, oh, what a nice old woman. She's just interested in her neighbor and she's asking a lot of questions and she's a little nosy, right? But she's not actually interested, right? Because she's very engaged with Rosemary when she's asking Rosemary questions about her fertility and if she wants to have children and these kind of things, right? But when they have dinner at their apartment and Rosemary and Minnie are doing the dishes and Rosemary is talking about her family and how many brothers she has and stuff, Minnie could care less. She is not interested in Rosemary as a person at all.
She's only interested in the family do you have people who are going to come in and worry about you and look in on you?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is abusers pick people who don't have close families, who don't have a large friend circle.
And it's so well done. It's so subtle.
Yeah.
And then, of course, with Roman, he is a blowhard. He doesn't speak, he monologues.
Yeah. But in a way that is oddly charming in that way, because he's obviously a very well-traveled, well-educated man. He's seen a ton of stuff. And if he's very verbose, well, he's a drunk old man. You know, and yet again, watching him, he is just absolutely fucking insane. I love the part when he's talking about, like, the gesture. Like, again, the first time you watch it, he's actually seen Guy and he's complimenting him and he's just being a sweet old man. And then you watch it and you're like, he never saw this fucking play. He is cold reading him. He is flattering him. He is slowly hooking his claws into him. He knows exactly what he wants to do. He knows exactly that he recognizes Guy as a very vain person and he can play upon them. He's ambitious and these are his flaws that he's going to hook in.
Yeah, because that's exactly what Roman and Minnie are, right? They're abusers, and they are they're cult members, and they're attempting to, you know, read these people in such a way as to figure out if this is the couple that they can use. And it's you know, once you know what's going on with the movie, and I think that's what's so interesting about it, is that, you know, I probably will put something on the post for this podcast. Like, if you've never seen Rosemary's Baby before, like, don't listen to this podcast until you watch it, because the first time you watch this movie, you get an entirely different experience than after you know exactly what's going on. And I know it's difficult probably to watch this movie without knowing, you know, kind of the broad strokes of the plot at least, but it is really important, I think, to, at least at first glance, not entirely know where this is going to go.
Yeah.
And watch Minnie and Roman as just a harmless old couple that are nice and kind of, you know, doddering, but they're asking questions and they want to get to know their neighbors because they're lonely. As Rosemary says, how wrong is she?
I mean, the first time I saw this, again, I was 13 or 14, and, you know, maybe I wasn't as genre savvy as I might be now, but I legitimately was not sure until she walks into that room at the end. Is this legitimately all stuff she has built up? Is this just a difficult pregnancy, a troubled marriage, and just a bunch of things colliding in order to build up the situation that she believes that, you know, or are there literally witches that are trying to steal her child?
Right, right. And, well, I want to talk a little bit about the witches and the Satanist part then, because I think this is the part of the movie that has aged the least well.
Yeah, and I think we know why, because Satanists aren't the enemy anymore. The Christian right is. That's who's trying to control women's bodies. Is that
right? Exactly. I mean, like, yeah, it's so strange, because that is the part of the movie that, like, a lot of this movie feels very vibrant and feels still very, very sort of au courant and doesn't feel dated at all. And I think that, you know, we haven't talked a lot about Roman Polanski's directing style and that kind of thing, but I think we should talk about it after this. But the Satanist stuff just feels very dated, because that was something that was, you know, very, that was a big hot topic of conversation in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And you remember, like, the D&D stuff, and now no one talks about that. I mean, yeah, there are Satanists, and I think I might have had a friend who was a Satanist at one point, and they're fine. They're just, you know,
I was gonna just people. I think we understand Satanism as just a general philosophy, and it's just mostly gothy people who do some rituals, and they don't actually steal babies. And I mean, the actual Church of Satan, as founded by Anton LaVey, you know, does on paper believe in bodily autonomy and stuff. There have been satanic groups who have tried to conjure the devil, and they have used volunteers, because let's face it, there are women who would want to bear the spot of Satan and would agree to that.
Well, and also, I mean, I think a lot of Satanists don't actually worship Satan.
It's
right?
Satan as an archetype and ideal. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, what can you really say about it? I think that this is a very, I mean, this comes directly from the novel, of course, and this would have been a very sort of thing that was used to thrill and shock people. And the idea of Satanists as witches who want to bring about the end of the world through the Antichrist and all of these sorts of things, that is something that it was very of the time and feels very dated now, because that has fallen out of fashion, because we now kind of have a different understanding of what, like, you know, the Catholic Church is doing, for instance.
And,
you know, I think that especially that scene at the dinner table where Roman is criticizing the Catholic Church and making Rosemary feel uncomfortable is not necessarily a conversation that a lot of people nowadays wouldn't have been involved in at some point. Without the Satanist undertones, of course.
Yeah. No, of course. Certainly one could talk about even a charitable, faithful Catholic view says that there were a lot of bad things that happened, which were, you know, I think they would view that as more aberrations, but would still acknowledge that things needed to be done. It wouldn't be as shocking to Rosemary to hear that today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it seems to be the evangelicals who want the second coming and the end of the world, not the Satanists. The Satanists are having too much fun here.
Yeah, exactly. The Satanists don't want the end of the world.
I guess what the last to put a cap in it is that I feel like the cruelest thing that they do to Rosemary, though, is at the end when they're talking about how they say, oh, you lost the baby. They even say, well, you know, if this had been in a hospital, I would have been able to take care of that. Like, they blame her for the baby's death. They basically said,
yeah,
you got too curious. You read books. I mean, there's literally a part where Dr. Saperzin says, I don't want you to read books. And in context, he's saying, I listen to your doctor rather than, you know, advice from WebMD, which is sensible in its own way. But, you know, she's literally told not to read books in this because they want to keep her ignorant. At the end, they're basically like, yeah, if you hadn't gotten uppity, you would have had your baby. But this baby is dead. And they don't outright say it's because of you, but this is a Catholic girl. She connects the dots. Like, I don't know. That to me is just fucking cruel.
Well, right, and I think that's the ultimate.
Yeah,
that's the ultimate line of the movie. Right, is that it's cruel that it. I mean, even at the end of the movie, when they tell her that the baby is dead, and they are ostensibly quote unquote taking care of her in her time of need.
Yeah.
They are still treating her as an object. They're still only taking care of her because they need the breast milk. And
yeah,
once that baby is old enough to eat solid food, I'm sure that they will not give two shits about Rosemary. And I think that, you know, just to talk about the ending of the movie a little bit, that is what the ultimate turn of the key there, where Roman realizes that she has become so gaslighted and brainwashed and paranoid and just turned around by this entire experience that she has finally reached the stage where she can be pushed a little bit and come around to their side, essentially, that she will take care of the baby for them, that they don't need the old woman to take care of the baby for them because her maternal instincts are going to kick in and she is going to, I mean, whether or not maternal instincts even exist, which is an entirely different question, but like,
yeah,
she is going to want to do that, that Roman has, and the rest of them have broken her down far enough that she is able, they're able to talk her into that. And Roman is able to recognize that.
So, I mean, I love how ambiguous the ending is. Again, this is another bit that the book makes a little clearer, is that, first of all, you know, she's talking through the movie, oh, Andy or Jenny, and she, you know, that's what she wants to name the baby, and they, you know, the cult names the baby Adrian. Well, in the book, she insists, no, his name is Andrew, and they, you know, Roman says, okay, his name is Andrew, that's fine, you're his mother. And also, when she's looking at the baby at the end, she has thoughts to the thing of, well, you know, he may be the spawn of Satan, but a mother's love can redeem. And imagine if he's raised right, and maybe I can take him away from this cult's influence. So there is a little bit more of, they do frame it as a tiny victory for her in the beginning of a bit of rebellion or something like that. But as you say, it could be that she's just been beaten down so much that she kind of gives up. It could also be that, I mean, when Roman says, listen, you're his mother, you are his mother, you know, just be a mother to your child. It's the first time anybody in the movie intuits what she wants and offers it to her and says, yeah, this is what you want to do. Okay. I mean, I almost get the sense that maybe if they'd asked her in the first place, she might have even done it. Just, at a, you know, it just would have been nice to have been asked.
Yeah, that's the ultimate lesson of the movie, is it would have been nice to have been asked.
Yeah.
Well, leaving aside the plot and the textual and subtextual, I do want to talk just a little bit to end the podcast about, you know, the kind of the look of the movie and how it slots into to the evolution of American filmmaking, because I do think that it is a seminal film in that way, you know. Other films, of course, very famous, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and those kind of films. And even going back as far as some of like Billy Wilder stuff or, you know, things like that. But it is the case that this was a very different type of movie that people had not really seen before. And, you know, Roman Polanski, like we said earlier, this was his first American movie. He had become well known for Repulsion and Cul-de-Sac and Knife in the Water. And You know, Repulsion, I think, has the most direct, you know, sort of like link back to Rosemary's Baby, as I said earlier. And, you know, a lot of what makes this movie so striking is, you know, kind of the ways in which Roman Polanski is able to really engender a sense of claustrophobia through the use of the camera. And, you know, a lot of the shots on the streets of Manhattan, which is something that was uncommon at the time, to say the least, because you could not control that environment in any way, shape or form. And there's a really interesting juxtaposition between the control that Polanski had of the apartment set and all of the sort of interior sets, and then sort of like the total chaos of the streets of Manhattan. And, you know, we don't get outside that much, right? I mean, there's only a few scenes that take place outside. But when they do, they still feel claustrophobic, which is,
I mean,
because he keeps the camera so low.
I mean, it's interesting because this does play with the – I mean, she especially says like the reason there are so few outside the apartment scene is because she even admits she barely goes out anymore. And it's the apartment is both a safe haven for her. It is a refuge that she has decorated exactly how she wants. I mean, this is the only thing she really does have any control over. She can – you know, she can decorate the place exactly how she wants. And, you know, the fact that she's working on it the entire time, I mean, suggests she does have an eye for taste and all of those things. I mean, that may be the one interest we can definitely say that she has. But, of course, this the safety of the apartment is a lie because everything bad has happened because she is shut up in it. And it literally has a back door that you just move two shelves and the Satanists are next door. You know, they don't even have a lock protecting them.
That part of it is so fascinating to me because that entire apartment, I mean, it both does and does not feel like a set. And that is really, I mean, textually and subtextually, that is fascinating because, yes, of course, that is a way in which the Satanists are able to move into her apartment and ultimately tie her down and make her give birth. But it is also kind of a subtextual thing in that their apartment is the stage on which this story is being told, and the backstage is the Castevet's apartment, which is where the real action is being is happening, and all of the setup and all of the control is, which is a fascinating little bit of sort of like mise en scène.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of, like, you know, you have somebody's locked in, you know, science fiction things. We have somebody locked in an apartment, and then outside them is the laboratory where they're studying them.
Yeah. All right, well, I think we'll call it a patron special. We have had a good time talking about Rosemary's Baby, and we hope that you have had a good time listening to it. It is a fantastic movie and, once again, one of my favorites. Next month, November, it's going to be Thanksgiving in America, and we are going to talk about the classic 1980s John Hughes comedy starring John Candy and Steve Martin, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, A Story of Two Strangers. Just trying to get home for Thanksgiving.
Aw.
So that'll be coming at you next month. As we always do, we just want to take an opportunity to thank you so very much for your continued support of Trek About. It is so appreciated. And we will never sick a Satanist cult on you as long as you continue to give us money. All right. Continue to listen to Trek About, and we'll see you next month for another patron special.
Bye.